Hello and welcome to Love is a Message, a podcast about music, the dance floor and counterculture. My name is Tim Lawrence and I'm joined here as always with Jem Gilbert. Hi, Jem.
Hello.
Hello, hello. And our very special guest today, who has not been on the show before, but we hope will come back many times if we can persuade him, is Mark Anthony Neal. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how you doing?
Well, good, thanks. It's such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, this is really awesome. So Mark Anthony Neal is the James B. Duke Distinguished Professor of African and African American Studies and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He's the author of What the Music Said, Black Popular Music and Black Public Culture, which was published in 1999 and was one of the most influential books I read as I started to kind of get into researching music culture. Also, the memoir New Black Man, published in 2005, another book called Soul Babies, Black Popular Culture and the Post-Soul Aesthetic, which was from 2002. And from 2013, Looking for Leroy, Illegible Black Masculinity. So prolific author. Mark is also the co-editor of another key text and reference point for me. That's The Joint, the Hip Hop Studies Reader. And Mark also hosts the video webcast Left of Black. So welcome, Mark. We feel there's definitely a lot of synergy here between what you do and what we aspire to do and maybe occasionally do a little bit of in our own work. And that's draw the lines between, you know, music and what, you know, when we're talking about Black popular music, inevitably relates often to some kind of dancing, although not always. And of course, you know, the politics of this culture, which you've educated so many of us in. I thought, just to get things rolling, it would be really wonderful if you could just tell us about your journey into, you know, writing all these books, in particular the first one, What the Music Said, and, you know, from, you know, your upbringing and I believe the South Bronx, the influence of your parents, the role of music listening for them, and, you know, what really shaped your, you know, your outlook, and, you know, as you were growing up and then eventually came to decide to write books.
So I definitely grew up in a musical household. Neither my parents were musicians, but they loved music. My father tended to listen to a lot of the gospel quartets, the Mighty Clouds of Joy, Highway QC, Sam Cooke and the Soul Stirrers. He also would do a little jazz and blues thing, particularly B.B. King, Jimmy Smith, Jimmy McGriff, you know, the two Jimmies. My mother, who was more a fan of 45s and really would just buy 45 records that she liked, you know, her two biggest artists, the artists that she loved the most, were Aretha Franklin and Shirley Caesar, the gospel singer, right? So I grew up with a lot of that in the household. When I was old enough to go to concerts and very young, my parents, you know, would drag me along. So I got to see the Supremes at the Apollo, you know, in 1971. I was 5 years old. I got to see Aretha when she did that famous stand, week-long stand to the Apollo in 1971, you know, with, wow, the band led by King Curtis. You know, it would have been the same tour that produced Live at the Fillmore. So, wow. So there's a way in which I was already familiar with that set before I ever heard the album the year later. And then, you know, understanding that I was developing my own musical taste, I got to see the Jackson 5 in Madison Square Garden in 1978. So I'm 5 years old. My parents are just taking me to concerts, not knowing what kind of impact it would have on me later. And at least in terms of my father, you know, working class guy, worked all the time. Our biggest connections were baseball and music. So I think I began to dig into the archive of his records, you know, just to get a better understanding of who he was. But, you know, in retrospect, because I spent a lot of time with my mother played music all the time. You know, I write about this in Black Ephemera. We had a little 650, 700 square foot apartment flat. There were two giant mantle sized speakers in the living room. There was a third speaker on top of a cabinet in the kitchen and a fourth speaker in my mother's bed, in my mother and father's bedroom. And so Saturdays and Sundays, it was just music 14 hours a day, you know, Al Green, you know, the whole gamut of what we think of as classic soul music from that period.
What a period to live through and to have got to the Apollo. Yeah. I'm officially jealous. So, I mean, I've heard you, I've read and I've also heard you speak about the role that, you know, music played for your parents in terms of, you know, I suppose one could say pleasure, but also a sense of survival.
That's definitely the case with my father. You know, the music was a solve, you know, for my father. That's the way he kind of recovered, you know, with his small bottle of Johnny Walker Red and some good music. I mean, he was only, you know, he worked 6 days a week, so Sundays were his day. So, you know, he'd make breakfast to music. He'd relax, you know, his version of the man cave. To music, I think it was a critically important aspect. I think for my mother, music gave her an outlet to a social world. You know, I think about hearing songs like the Woman to Woman songs, you know, Shirley Brown and all those kinds of folks, you know, these kind of serial response records that were popular in soul music in the mid-1970s. And I think for her, it replicated this kind of social world. A rumor, innuendo, and all those kinds of things. So that stuff was critically important. And it was important to me also. I give my parents a lot of credit for giving me the space to develop my own musical taste. They didn't want me messing with their stereo system. So I got my first stereo system when I was about 5. I got an upgrade by the time I was 13, right? My mother would take me to record stores. I mean, the first album that I bought that I think of as my first album is that Jackson 5 third album, you know, with I'll Be There and all those kind of tracks on it. So, yeah, they gave me a lot of space to develop my own taste in music. And, of course, you know, as we all are, I was part of the Walkman generation. So, you know, when those first generations of Walkman came up and you could listen to everything privately, you know, it was just a beautiful world. You know, I couldn't afford a lot of records as a kid, but I would do air recordings, you know, from popular radio stations, you know, here in the States. You know, pop stuff, listening to WABC radio. I was fortunate to be in New York with the great DJ Frankie Crocker. You know, so listening to his mixes and the kind of things that he tried to introduce to Black audiences, it was just a very rich musical culture, right? And the fact that even today, you know, I listen to Chicago as often as I listen to Earth, Wind, and Fire, as often as I listen to Queen, you know, as often as I still listen to Sam Cooke and the Soul Stirrers, you know, kind of speaks to the richness of the musical culture that I was able to be brought up in.
Mm. So you're describing, I think, sort of, you know, coming of age in a sense musically in the 1970s, going to the Apollo. So were your family home in the South Bronx?
Yes.
I mean, it's reported as being obviously a turbulent time.
Yeah. You know, born and raised in the South Bronx, and, you know, old enough to remember Howard Cosell, you know, covering a World Series game and describing the Bronx as burning. I never felt the way that people describe the place. I remember when Paul Newman's Fort Apache, The Bronx comes out and it becomes this own kind of narrative about how are people living this way and how are they surviving. And, you know, what I remember about growing up in the South Bronx were very close-knit families. Close-knit communities, you know, these were, you know, folks who were just migrated, as was the case with my parents, from the Deep South. They often made connections when they migrated to New York with other folks they knew from the Deep South. So I always just saw it as community, and music was an important bridge to that community, right? And of course, you know, as you mentioned, it's the South Bronx in the 1970s. So there's this other thing that's popping off. Right, that I'm not socially a part of because I'm young. But at least by the time I hear Rapper's Delight for the first time on the radio, you know, in 1979, I had a context for it. Haven't been listening to, you know, hip hop still in the streets, plugged into lights outside, you know, and stuff like that. People doing extension cords from the windows of their apartment all the way down to the park and those kind of things. You know, for me, when I heard Rapper's Delight, it was just, oh, this rap thing is now on the radio, right? Because I had an earlier context for it.
I said a hip hop, the hip to the hip, hip hop, you don't stop the rocking to the bang bang boogie. Say up, jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogie to beat. Now what you hear is not a test, I'm rapping to the beat. And me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet. You see, I am Wonder Mike, and I like to say hello. Up to the black, to the white, the red, and the brown, and the purple, and yellow.
I'm interested what you were making of this as a kid, kind of, because of course Frankie Crocker was big into disco. And early rap, you know, all the rappers were, all the DJs, I mean, I interviewed Bambaza, they were all playing disco, as it happens with a lot of other stuff. I mean, for me, the turning point was 1978, and, you know, when disco seemed to take over, and Euro disco was foregrounded. And then, but at that point, all of the DJs that Jem and I might also be interested in also were getting sick and tired of disco. So it wasn't just people organizing, you know, parties in the South Bronx. But I'm interested in your experience as you know, a kid, basically, hearing these sounds, hearing, you know, the building blocks of what comes to be rap music, and how you related to those.
You know, I was fortunate as a kid to have a really robust musical palette. You know, I didn't listen to a lot of what we might think of the popular funk of the era as a kid, right? So I wasn't listening to the Ohio Players. I didn't listen to much Parliament Funkadelic. I mean, those weren't acts that my parents listened to. My parents didn't listen to Earth, Wind, and Fire, but my best friend and his father did. So they were my entry point. You know, my best friend, Frank Paul, and his father, Frank Sr., were my entry point into Earth, Wind, and Fire. The first Earth, Wind, and Fire album I bought was Fantasy. And that kind of opened up a whole wave of stuff for me. I heard the music on the radio, pop radio. You know, That's the Way of the World, Getaway, you know, Shining Star and stuff like that. But the kind of deepness of their kind of funk palette, I get, you know, when I start delving deep into the archive. But, you know, dance music was also very prominent. You know, my parents, my mother in particular, loved Philly International stuff. So you say Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, I was aware of, you know, stuff like The Love I Lost, Eddie Kendrick's Girl, You Need to Change Your Mind. You know, the Jackson 5 music that interested me the most as they grew was their dance music, right? So, you know, whether it's Dancing Machine, Michael singing Give Me a Little Bit of Love Every Time. I mean, it's all these kind of dance songs as they were trying to transition to something older.
Dancing, dancing.
She's a dancing machine.
And so, you know, I never thought about the music in any way that, you know, this is slow music, this is fast music. It was just the music that I liked. And in terms of hip hop, it really was being around some of my peers, and we started to get really interested into breakbeat culture. We were here, you know, older cats mixing stuff in the park that we found interesting. And we started to track down, you know, our own 12-inch records of some of these break beats and make our little rudimentary pause button mixes where, you know, we would find a break and hit the pause button and loop it again and then try to rap over it, you know, at the same time. I mean, it was so much fun. But, you know, to this day, when I hear songs like Apache or T-Connection's Groove to Get Down, I can remember when Dance to the Drummer's Beat comes out in 1978, TK, right? And they're doing an initial version of it, and then they do a disco remix that comes out a few minutes later, right? And so even those folks, as they're kind of producing songs that they know are being fed into this hip-hop culture, I think always thought of it as a dance culture in that same way.
It's very interesting to hear you recount this growing up with this music. And I guess the distinctions we, an analysis, if you like, that we apply later retrospectively is not what we necessarily experienced at the time, is it?
Right.
because it's fluid, you know, all of this is fluid. Everything is flowing into everything else, really. So how did you get from this life that you were leading growing up in the South Bronx to the point where you wrote or started to write What the Music Said? And then we'll get stuck into the arguments, which are, you know, major for us.
So I went, you know, I went to college initially to be an engineering student. That didn't work out. That didn't work out quite well. But I always wrote, you know, I kept diaries when I was a kid. I used to write little mini screenplays when I was a kid. So I always had a writing skill. And it was difficult at the time to tell my parents that I was going to college to become an English major, because they had no idea, you know, what I was supposed to do with that. But that's how I got started. And the big shift for me, because I graduated from college, I sold computers for 2 or 3 years. The big change for me was, well, twofold. One, it was reading The Village Voice in New York City, which at the time was a free weekly. You know, they would come out on Thursdays and they'd be sitting there and you just grab it, hop on the subway. And I lived, you know, in the Bronx, but I often worked in Manhattan, went to high school in Brooklyn. So I was always hour and a half, 2 hour train rides. So The Village Voice was great. You know, you hop on the train and just sit there and read it. And it was in the pages of Village Voice where I first got introduced to Nelson George. Most importantly, I got introduced to the late Greg Tate. And so their writing piqued my interest in this writing world that people were writing about music. Nelson, in the sense that it was really kind of straightforward, a kind of reporter's view of what was happening in the culture that I appreciated. And then, of course, Greg was a little bit more esoteric, you know, more esoteric references, much more out the box in terms of creativity, right? And the two of them really gave me an indication of how different ways in which you could do this. But when Nelson George drops A Death of Rhythm and Blues in 1988, you know, for me, in my head, it was a rap. You know, that's like, I want to figure out how to do this for a living, you know, in some way. I didn't know how to do that other than, you know, poems, because I was a poet, you know, in college and writing, you know, essays for classes. You know, I didn't know how to do music criticism or anything like that. It was going into graduate school initially just to get certification to teach in high school and being introduced to folks who were doing work in cultural studies, Cornel West, Bell Hooks, Mike Eric Dyson, that I made the decision that, you know, maybe to bring the kind of energy that I felt in popular journalism into the academy. Right. And so, you know, my dissertation that I write at the University of Buffalo becomes What the Music Said. You know, and at the time here in the U.S., you know, there were people who were obviously popular music scholars. Charlie Kyle, you know, the great Charles Kyle was one of my mentors at the University of Buffalo. So there were people obviously doing that kind of work. But I didn't see, at least from my purview, a lot of folks in the academy that were writing the way Nelson George or Lisa Jones or Joan Morgan or Greg Tate, you know, were writing about Black popular music in the academy. So that was the path for me.
So getting into the detail of What the Music Said, which was published in 1990. I'm just trying to give it 98 or 99. It is 99. Yeah, I thought so. Well, I think it's better for you to describe the argument of the book than me to describe it. So could you just like, you know, present the a sort of summary of the of what you really, what you try and do in the book?
Yeah, I think I was trying to make the argument, and it was a post-World War II argument, definitely, that if you listen to Black popular music, you will get an insight to Black social, political, and cultural life. That as you tap into the music at any particular historical moment, you'll find out what's going on about Black people. And, you know, hence the title, you know, what the music said. I remember the initial title of it, and this was actually the title of my dissertation, was Discursive Soul. And I remember, you know, the great Bill Germano, who was my editor at Routledge at the time, was like, no, we're not going to do that. I want to say it was Discursive Soul, Black Music in the Public Sphere, something along those lines. And Bill was like, no, we're not going to do that. We're just going to call this What the Music Said. And so, you know, I tried to the best that I could, you know, and, you know, as the two of you know, this is a different era of research. You know, there's no Google. There's no YouTube. There's no streaming music services, right? And you know, I was someone who never wanted to write about music that I never listened to. You know, so it was only the stuff that you could have in the archive that you had access to that you could really write about, right? So it was a challenge, you know, in that regard, right? So I had to be very particular in terms of what archives I would use based on stuff that I was familiar with, listened to a lot. You know, one of the great gifts of this research and this time for me is that I did a college radio show while I was in grad school called Soul Expressions, WCVF in Fredonia, New York. It was a Sunday morning show. I would get up early on Sundays, lay out my playlist, and for 3 hours, you know, play whatever the hell I wanted to play in terms of soul music. And they had this tremendous vinyl archive that no one used. You know, because at this time, all the younger, because all the folks on the radio station are undergrads, you know, they're doing CDs and stuff like that. I go into these archives and, you know, for lack of a better way to describe it, and I've told this story many times, I liberated some things. the most famous one I remember was Eugene McDaniel's Headless Heroes of the Apocalypse.
Left wing and right wing. Political pawns in the master game. The player who controls the board sees them all as the same. Basically, cannon fodder.
Which I had no context for. I was like, I'm like, what is this, right? Sit down and listen to it. Hear this kind of larger history of Eugene McDaniels, right, doing this album and Spiro Agnew reaching out and telling him this is a problem and being dropped from his label. It's like, okay, this is actually the story that I want to tell. I tried to tell a story about how Black music was responsive to the social and political conditions of Black folks in many different eras, taking that from the emergence of this new sound of soul music, you know, in the 1950s, really up to the first 15 years of hip hop, you know, in the 1990s.
Hmm. So I just want to ask you one more question and then maybe hand over to Jem for a bit. But if you could talk more also about the poles that kind of define the two main poles or axes that define, you know, this sort of detailed, you know, it's detailed, but it's also, you know, analytical and deeply theoretical account you give of the, you know, the rise of you know, African American music from, you know, the spirituals onwards. And it's an extraordinary kind of account that you provide. And in terms of the broad kind of the poles that you refer to, could you speak to those really? I mean, on the one hand, you have what you call the Black public sphere. And on the other hand, you have the mainstream, where the Black aspects of the Black public sphere in various ways get to be, I think you at one point you say, subsumed by market interests.
I love the idea that there was a communal critique that existed in the context of Black communities and the production of Black music, right? There were things that people were listening to, you know, in Black communities that because of language, the type of words that you use, style, gestures, things that would only resonate for another Black audience. You know, so when you talk about this idea, you know, as Henry Louis Gates does in Signifying Monkey, of doublespeak, right? Saying one thing publicly and having multiple meanings. I often felt, you know, as I tried to write, that that's what Black music tried to do, right? So when you listen to Louis Jordan, you know, Ain't Nothing Here But Us Chickens, right? It's not just simply a song about a bunch of chickens, you know, in a chicken coop, right? It resonates on different kinds of levels. The way those 1950s raunchy R&B stars, You know, I think about, you know, Moose Jackson's 12-inch record, right? And the way that he says, or 10-inch record, the way he says 10-inch, right? And the little pause there to suggest that he's talking about something other than a record, you know, in that context. I loved how that kind of language and that use of wordplay, you know, resonated within Black audiences that the mainstream would largely be, you know, ambivalent, you know, wouldn't have any sense of. And for Black audiences, it then means that the music becomes a primary way to politicize messaging, particularly in the 1960s. I think the 1960s is important in this regard because it's still a moment where generationally, Black folks are largely listening to the same kinds of music. So everyone's listening to Curtis Mayfield in the Impressions, right? You know, everyone is listening to some extent, you know, Sam Cooke in an earlier moment. We don't get that kind of generational divide to emerge, really, I would argue, to the late 1980s, right? Because even in early hip hop and some of the early samples, I always think about Eric B. and Rakim's sampling of Don't Look Any Further as kind of being like the last hip hop song that both your grandmother and your grandchild, right, might listen to.
I feel great, so maybe I might just search for a 9 to 5. If I strive, then maybe I'll stay alive. So I walk up the street whistling this, feeling out of place, cause man, do I miss a pen and a paper, a stereo, a tape for me and Eric being a nice big plate of fist, which is my favorite dish, but without no money, it's still a wish.
But of course, there's different kind of pressures, right? Soul music, you know, really is the mainstreaming of Black American culture in the U.S. in the 1960s. And so these kind of messages that take place that become important, these narratives, these discourses that are existing in Black communities, you know, suddenly you have other folks who can listen in on what's happening, and the market has different kinds of desires, right? And so I often appreciated the way that Black artists, you know, try to at the same time continue to be connected to Black communities at the same time they're trying to reach wider audiences. And I often think that soul music was perfect for that, right? Because it allowed for this kind of duality of messaging, you know, to occur.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's sort of just stating a truism for our show in a way that soul music seems to occupy this paradigmatic status in the kind of history that we're talking about. Partly because it's the example you can point to really in the modern period of a musical movement that's been self-evidently sort of connected to political movements and has engaged in a sort of positive feedback loop with them. It's hard to think of other examples of that relationship working as well as it worked under those circumstances.
Agreed. I mean, one of the examples that I use, you know, in What the Music Said, and I still use teaching these days, is Ray Charles singing The Nighttime is the Right Time.
You know the nighttime now,
holiday,
is the right time,
holiday,
to be,
holiday,
with the one you love now,
holiday,
and I, oh baby,
holiday,
and I, come on baby, now,
holiday,
I want to be the one I love.
For me, that song is brilliant on so many different levels, you know, because, you know, it's a raunchy R&B song, right? But, you know, as was with so much of the early Ray Charles stuff, it's so deeply steeped in gospel culture. And, you know, it's that kind of song that Black folks, you know, listen to up in clubs on Saturday morning. And Ray Charles' genius was that he understood those same folks would be in, you know, sitting in pews in a church, you know, in a Baptist church the next day. And so why create two different musics, you know, create a sound that brings it all together, right? But when you hear a song like The Nighttime is the Right Time, you know, the political context of it, you know, obviously it's about, you know, being with someone after dark, right? But the nighttime is the right time. It also becomes, for the civil rights era, you know, a time of planning, a time of organizing, a time of reimagining what freedom could look like for Black Americans. And none of that is in the song, right? But of course, it's inferred in the song, right? You know, when Aretha sings Respect, right, and literally pauses to spell out respect. And yes, she's talking about, I need respect from this man. Of course, she borrowed this from Otis. But how she stopped to spell out respect resonated for Black audiences as demanding something more, right, in that political moment, right? So even if she had never intended it to be a political song, it had political connotations for many Black folks.
Absolutely. And then you've mentioned that generational bifurcation, actually, that happens around in the late 80s, which is, I don't know, to be honest, how much this is just my spontaneous analysis coinciding with yours, or I just got it from you in the first place, because I was like teaching. I've been teaching the book since it came out, basically. So I can't remember. But so I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that, because to me, that seems a really pivotal moment. The late 80s, seems like a pivotal moment in the history, both of Black American music, but also Black American politics, with the defeat of the second Jesse Jackson campaign and its implications.
You have to put a lot of this on Black media, Black radio in particular. Black radio, which, you know, had grown up from its early days, you know, 30s, 40s, and 50s, to become something that was institutionally important, right? Again, growing up in New York and the impact of a station like WBLS, Inner City Broadcasting, you know, a company that was founded in part by Percy Sutton, who's Malcolm X's legal counsel, you know, before Malcolm X is killed. You know, they are building a brand that's largely about connecting advertisers to Black people with money, right? Black working class, Black middle class folks. And they're trying to protect that at every means. And hip hop is the sound that's out the box, right? That older Black folks are already pushing back against. It's just the noise that's happening in the street, right? As some seasoned musicians would say, I remember late Nancy Wilson saying this on Arsenio Hall's show. She goes, it's not music, right? It doesn't have melody, right? For me, for something to be music, it has to have melody. And so Black radio makes a decision, right, not to support the playing of rap music. And when they do, it's always after hours. It's on some specialty show, right? One of the reasons why we know about the world famous Supreme Team is because they took advantage, you know, of a gap in the presentation of rap music in the early 1980s in New York on a very small radio station. And they cultivated a following that eventually, you know, the mainstream radio stations had to follow. This is still an era in which, you know, when you start to get this bleeding together of R&B and rap stars, I'm thinking about Jody Watley's Friends, you know, and Rakim jumps on, you know, record companies are producing versions of these R&B songs without the rap, largely in response to radio stations saying, can you give us a version of without this rapping thing? So, you know, there's already this kind of bifurcation that's coming because of the corporate reality of this. And then I think, you know, because rap music, for good or bad, is representation of Black youth culture at the time, you have an older generation that's almost celebrating the victories of the civil rights generation. And then you have these younger folks who are saying, we're not witnessing those victories. I mean, that's, you know, when you listen to The Message in 1982, right, that's the most striking example of that, right? And then this generation becomes politicized. I mean, you mentioned Jesse Jackson and you know, his defeat first in 84 and 88, you know, seems like the end of political opportunity. But of course, undergirding that moment is, you know, a generation of young Black folks who get politicized in very, very significant ways. You know, you can't talk about the Jesse Jackson moment without talking about his earlier friendship that, of course, gets fractured with Louis Farrakhan, and how appealing that was, you know, for young Black folks to see the kind of coming together of Malcolm X's lieutenant with Martin Luther King's lieutenant and what the political possibilities were there. when we see Public Enemy emerge, right, 86, 87, 88, for me, that was the more important political moment than the defeat in Jesse Jackson, right? And I still talk about this to this day. You know, Chuck D would go around beyond the music talking to folks. It's like, you know, this music is about producing 5,000 Black leaders. And as a 20-something, I wanted to be one of them. You know, and at least for me personally, my choice was to be able to pursue that as an academic, you know, as opposed to a journalist or a political leader or something along those lines.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that's great. That's really useful. So I wonder if you could say something more then about the broader context for all this, even going back into the 60s, even the 50s, in terms of the relationship between this Black public culture that emerges primarily through music culture and the tensions between that as, on the one hand, a commodity culture, a culture which becomes increasingly inserted into and dependent upon the circuits of capital accumulation on the one hand, and on the other hand, its function as indeed as a public sphere, as a public culture, as a site of community formation.
What I loved about talking about and thinking about this community formation was the way that Black community helped to shape what got produced in the name of Blackness, if you will. To some extent, we romanticize about something like Showtime at the Apollo. But these were things that occurred in many different Black performance venues. Audiences, working class people a lot of times, right? But also, you know, a kind of mix of working class, middle class, even elite Black folks. One of the few places where they would all come together might be at a concert hall, you know, to listen to an artist. And the pressure that they place on these artists to not sound like somebody else. Right. You know, if you're Nat King Cole, we don't want you to sound like Charles Brown. Right. If you're Ronald Isley, right, we don't want you to sound like Sam Cooke. And I'm reading this great book by Michelle Scott now about Toba Time, you know, Tough on Black Asses, the theater owner's booking agency. Right. And she talks in the book about how, you know, this Chitlin circuit dynamic, you know, which is partly what I'm trying to discuss in terms of the communal aspect of Black music, right? It's a proven ground, right? The audience tells you what it wants and what it needs and what you're not doing. Joe Sample tells this great story, you know, on a Marcus Miller album called Tales about going into these, you know, barns and things in Texas and trying to play straight ahead jazz as they would with the jazz messengers. And the audience is telling them, we ain't trying to listen to that. Right. This is a Saturday night. We spent some good money. We want some nice bluesy, slow music that we can get our groove on. Right. And keep it moving. So I think in that regard, that part of the community interaction was important. But at the same time, artists are trying to be able to live a life. I don't think there's any Black artists that didn't think that at some point they wanted to cross over. The question was always, what would be the cost of crossing over, right? And crossing over is when, you know, the corporate entities become more involved in it, right? And you know, the beauty of Black music really until the 1970s is that it's still largely an independent operation. Even Motown, to some extent, is still an independent record company. When you get to that period, and Nelson George writes, you know, so brilliantly about this, you know, of the so-called Harvard Report, Clive Davis, you know, that moment trying to figure out a way for these corporate entities to rein in and take control of Black music, obviously to make money from it, in the 1970s, you know, that's when we see the shift. I give Clive Davis a lot of credit, at least in the beginning, of understanding that he couldn't necessarily build this brand himself. So to be able to find Gamble and Huff, right, folks who kind of had their ear to the street, who had their experiences as both producers and songwriters, who knew artists, who had a network of folks that they could tap into, you know, and just give them the resources to do what they could do best. And at least from 1972 to 1976, you know, before everything else catches up to them, you know, that sound is a defining sound of Black music in the 1970s, right? And to, again, to Gamble and Huff's credit, you know, they understood the range of emotions that Black communities had. You know, so you could get a ballad like Mrs. Jones with Billy Paul, Teddy Pendergrass as the lead singer of Harold Melvin, the Blue Notes would give you great ballads, but also this dance music, right? You know, MFSB, title of your podcast, Love is the Message. I mean, Love is the Message is, you know, it means a lot of things, right? But that, you know, that song, that 12-minute version, you know, that gets remixed, you know, in the mid-1970s. I mean, that's just classic Black culture, period. Mm-hmm.
Tim doesn't like that song, do you? I'll play that song at least once a year, DJing.
This is
too cheesy for you, isn't it?
It's a little bit more complex than that. It's an incredible song. It's always my favorite dance song.
And I loved, you know, what I loved about Gamble and Huff is that if people didn't get the point, right, they were more on the nose with it, right? So you're going to have to read this essay on the back of the album jacket, right? So we can lay out to you what we really think the Black family should be, right, as one example of that on the Family Reunion album. And so there were artists, I think, in record companies that learned how to manage the pressures of still being connected to Black communities and also selling records, right? You know, from 72 to 76, you know, PIR was a successful record company. When they launched Teddy Pendergrass as a solo artist, and he carries the label really for the next 5 or 6 years, right? He does so as the most popular, you know, Black solo male artist ever. You know, there's 5 straight gold records, et cetera, et cetera. I think that next generation of record labels and record producers didn't feel as much around that connection. You know, for all the great stuff that L.A. Reid and Babyface did with LaFace and obviously Jam and Lewis, you know, with Perspectives and then whatever their production work was, it didn't have that same kind of political edge, that mainstreaming of Black politics, right, that we saw with Gamble and Huff. I think Jam and Lewis did it better in that regard. I think about The Sounds of Blackness is really kind of an extraordinary way to articulate a kind of Black communal experience in that particular moment. Babyface and L.A. Reid seemed less invested, right, in that kind of politics. And it's hip-hop that fills the gap, right, where R&B kind of backs away from having a kind of political messaging. You know, it's hip-hop that fills the void.
Right.
Love is the message.
I'd love to go forwards, but I also want to kind of rewind a little bit and sort of have you describe some of the building blocks, if you like, of the Black public sphere, because I'm just we haven't really done enough of that on this show, and what you write is so compelling, I just think we will be crazy for us not to have you talk to this. So I mean, one, you know, so there's, you know, there's obviously there is slavery, and the enormity of that experience is impossible to overestimate. I'm interested in what you might say about maybe the impossibility or the extremely marginalized possibility of a Black public sphere at that moment. It may be a total impossibility, but there were the beginnings clearly of resistance and communication through the spirituals. I'd love to hear you talk about how the church became, you know, one of the, you know, the key centers, if you like, for the Black public sphere, and something that was accepted by the white community on the understanding that the spread of Christianity was a good thing, but how the Black, you know, African-American community effectively used that space to kind of develop, you know, as to develop its own culture and its own voices, including, you know, very importantly, voices of resistance. And, you know, then how, you know, we saw, you know, whether it was rent jukes, juke joints or rent parties emerge as another crucial sphere for where, you know, cultures, you know, as, you know, incredibly important as ragtime even took root.
Yeah. So, I mean, we have to think about Black publics, even in the earliest moment, as being the opportunities where Black folks were allowed or could be able to congregate, to be able to communicate with each other, right? And we know there are already historical challenges in this regard, right? The loss of language, people coming together, you know, in terms of being on plantations and various places who use different language, right? It's not like there was a singular African language, you know, in that regard. The very clear understanding of the way that rhythm was significant in Black culture, and the way the use of rhythm was policed by slave owners and overseers. You know, Amir Baraka's great line that he borrows from West African traditions, you know, and blues people, right? The music does not descend without, the spirit does not descend without music. So there's a kind of musicality that's embedded in Black social life that's important to building community when community is in fact impossible. When I wrote What the Music Said, few of us knew what social media was. But I often think about, you know, the singing of some of these quote unquote slave songs in unison, you know, was a form of social media, right? It was a way for them to communicate with each other, right? And even if the lyrics don't contain necessarily meanings of resistance, the gestures that they would use in singing songs, kind of guttural expressions. I mean, there's so many different ways in which messaging was occurring on these plantations in the singing of these songs in community, right? Let alone the development of Black musical traditions, right? By doubling down on use of rhythm and melody, all the while trying to just simply pass the time, you know, in the hot sun, right? And there are many, you know, historians of slavery that have talked about the kind of messaging that's embedded in many of these songs where, you know, so you're singing Go Down Moses and Moses is not just, you know, this aping of Christianity, you know, in this moment, but, you know, Moses itself might be a metaphor for a cave or a field, you know, or someplace where they might congregate and begin to organize and plan. So in that regard, it was important. You know, obviously in the emancipation era, post-emancipation, you know, we start to see the actual building and attempt to sustain Black institutions. These institutions become important conduits, obviously, to build community, but also in terms to do organizing. The genius of the Black church, I think, was the way that it could exist and, you know, hidden in public sight, you know, for lack of a better way to say it, espousing a kind of passing on of Christian traditions, but it also became literally a site of organizing for Black folks because it's one of the few places where Black folks could come together and congregate. It's the very reason why Black political movement, well through the 20th century, was always going to be connected to the Black church tradition and the Black church meeting, because that's literally, right? I mean, we talk about Martin Luther King in 1955. I mean, they're organizing in a church, in his church, right? You know, that's why the Montgomery boycott happens, right? Now, of course, that's not the only church that's an example. But we also have these kind of, you know, more less formal institutions, as you mentioned, Tim, you know, the juke joints, you know, where folks are kind of playing with music and experimenting with sound and experimenting with the way that folks are responding to that. You know, by the time we get to the 1920s and we talk about, you know, the Theater Owners Booking Association and the Chitlin Circuit and some of these informal institutions are becoming more formal. You think about a figure like Georgia Tom, who for much of the 1920s is musical director for Ma Rainey, who's very well known, you know, in his role as a pianist of blues music. And, you know, he 3 years later becomes the father of gospel music when he has that kind of psychic conversion and writes Precious Lord and begins to create the industry of gospel music, not simply in the producing of the music, but the selling of the music. Right, traveling around the country with the sheet music and selling it to choirs and then teaching them how to sing the songs, you know, all the tools that he used to market gospel music in the 30s and the 40s, you know, are the tools that R&B stars and record labels and soul stars and record labels, they would use those same tools to market, you know, Black music in the 1950s. You know, so these community spaces were important, right? And then, you know, I talk about these kind of spaces of presentation, places like the Apollo and other theaters, you know, throughout the country, Black-owned theaters in many cases, where the community is able to immediately respond to these performances to say, yeah, nay. The famous story of Luther Vandross, who I think most folks would generally accept, was, you know, if not the best-selling, you know, which he wasn't, but one of the most important Black male vocalists, right, of the late 20th century, right? Clearly in terms of just sheer talent, right? One of the most talented of them. You know, this is someone who got booed off the stage 5 times you know, at the Apollo, right? Until he found his style, his sound that resonated. So I think these institutions have been critically important, right? And I would argue, as I do in the book, that the ability of the music to remain connected as a source of critique for the larger world was largely connected to the music still being connected to these institutions, right? And when you start to see Black flight in the 1970s, right, Black folks leaving Black communities, the middle class, you see that disconnect, right? And again, hip hop kind of fills a void, but it's a void that, you know, the Black middle class is largely trying to push away, right? Because in their mind, they had left that behind.
It's interesting that you cite this kind of shift in the 70s and the emergence of hip-hop. And of course, I mean, not immediately, but reasonably soon afterwards, certainly as the 80s progresses and, you know, Reagan's kind of, you know, economic reforms and, you know, only subtly racist discourse becomes embedded, hip-hop, its generation understands itself to be the first form of Black music, as I think you call it, you describe it in the book as speak the truth to power. And of course it did in many ways. It did a whole bunch of other things as well. It did do that. But one of the things you wanted to kind of do in what the music said is also counter this idea that black musical politics begins with hip hop. So I'm gonna drag you back again to Stax, to Nina Simone, to James Brown, to Marvin Gaye, to, you know, there's all these artists who are, you know, just in, you know, in their music and also the lives they're leading and their interaction with the public are shaping a Black political discourse.
I will say this, Tim. It is that search for those obscure narratives, those obscure songs and artists, you know, from that earlier period that are, in fact, speaking truth to power, that excited me the most of doing what the music said and still, you know, 25 years later, still excites me, you know, to find examples of that. We talk a lot about, in a hip-hop context, N.W.A. and F the Police, right? And the way that creates a culture of sanction, right, where folks are trying to, law enforcement is trying to hold them accountable. But even in that context, right, they never faced what Billie Holiday faced in response to Strange Fruit. They never lost the commercial opportunities that Nina Simone lost, you know, for Mississippi Goddamn explicitly, but for her attachment to the civil rights movement more broadly, right? I mean, you think about, you know, and this is out of a musical context, I mean, you think about what Dick Gregory gave up commercially, right, you know, in terms of opportunities for himself, simply because he chose to publicly align himself with the civil rights movement. You know, that was the case of a lot of artists. And so, you know, there is this larger tradition of resistance, even going back to the playful, you know, as Robin Kelly talks about with, you know, Louis Jordan and Ain't Nothing Here But Us Chickens. You even a song like, you know, we all know Public Enemies Fight the Power. I was fortunate enough to have a context for the Isley Brothers, you know, Fight the Power. When I first heard Public Enemy, that was my needy connection, right? This is an update of the Isley Brothers, a song that I remember, right? Mostly because they cussed in it. I was like, oh, wow, right? They just cussed on this song, right? And the Isley Brothers were not in any way outwardly political artists, right? Though in trying to own their brand and their own label and stuff like that, right? They clearly had a kind of political context to what they were doing, right? And the way that they actively inserted themselves into this larger tradition of rock and roll that they had been erased from. Right. You know, so they erased from the early days, right? And then the 3+3 you know, process tries to reintroduce them into a different kind of way into that kind of rock canon, and they get erased again. So, you know, for me, there are just so many different examples of artists who were doing music that spoke truth to power, right? You know, most famously, you know, we talk about Marvin Gaye and What's Going On.
Picket lines, and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Marvin's politics on that record, I would argue, I mean, the politics lyrically are blatant, right? But the production of it is subtle, right? The lushness of that recording, right? It made it easier to go down, if you will, right, in terms of political commentary. You know, when we think about Sly and the Family Stone, Stan, I think, is still their most remarkable contribution.
Set out to do. Stand.
There's a cross for you to bear.
Things to go through if you're going anywhere.
Ooh. To musical politics, right? I mean, you could say, you know, that about there's a riot that's going on. No, it's, you know, and in terms of the sonic quality of it, you know, it clearly is a revolutionary album. But even, you know, in Motown, when you listen to The Temptations' Ball of Confusion, you know, they're pushing back against the political realities also. So to think about hip-hop as being the first to do it is really a mischaracterization of what Black music has always done, right? Bessie Smith, Backwater Blues, 1927, is a political song, right? It's a song about what happens when water comes to the lowlands and Black people are forced to be the buffer between whiteness and property, right? And again, that's not explicit in the song, but, you know, that's what she's telling the story of in the song.
When it rains 5 days and the skies turn dark at night. When it rained 5 days and the skies turned dark as night, then trouble taking place in the lowlands at night.
So following on from that, then, what do you think happens broadly to the politicality of hip-hop and wider Black American music, like after the 1980s?
I think there are many Black artists who never assumed that they would achieve a level of mainstream success that would sustain them. So in that regard, there was a freedom in terms of the music that they recorded, right? Because, you know, what would sustain them would always be Black audiences, right? And as long as they reflected the life and conditions of Black audiences, there would always be support for their music. When we start to see the massive crossover, I think it becomes alluring. As much as I love Michael Jackson, as much as I love Prince, right, we could throw, and I never loved her as much, but, you know, we could put Whitney Houston into that next way. When we start to have these major, huge crossover stars, I think for many younger Black artists, it presented an opportunity to mimic that strategy to be successful. And you could do so now without needing a Black audience, right? Again, I think the career of Luther Vandross is so instructive. You know, Luther Vandross, for all intents and purposes, never crossed over, right? He was an artist who always had a solid R&B base. Part of it that was about the music, but it was also about his physicality, right? He did not have a body that could cross over. I would actually say his singing was so ornate right? It wasn't a pop voice that could cross over in that way, but his use of melisma and all these other things resonated, obviously, you know, for Black audiences. We start to get, you know, major Black pop stars who don't need Black audiences anymore and then aren't beholden to the political realities of Black life. Hip hop holds the line for a generation, right? But then when hip hop becomes that thing also, it has no need to do that now. I mean, I always felt that there were genres of Black music that would exist, that would circulate in Black communities. And whenever there was a threat of co-optation, right, via crossover, folks would just move on to another style, right, that could not be so easily co-opted. You know, for me, hip hop has always struck me as a genre of Black music that said, come co-opt us, right? Right? Take us, right? And I don't think we've seen anything that fills the gap afterwards, right? It almost feels, you know, at least in terms of the context of a story like that I try to tell and what the music said, that hip hop is the end of that line. Right. You know, and so even the thing that we think about is, you know, obviously hip hop was never explicitly political, but there are many ways in which it was. Right. I mean, when we think about hip hop, at least in the U.S., you know, in 2023, we think about something that is largely devoid of politics. Right. At least racial politics. Right. At least, you know, democratic, you know, social politics. Right. You know, there's some interesting gender politics, some of which are very problematic. You know, in terms of toxic masculinity and things like that. But we don't, you know, if folks were looking for what is Black America thinking right now, you wouldn't go to a hip hop song, right? Which is kind of unfathomable, right? To think that had we gone back to the late 1980s and the early 1990s, right? Where we always expect it, right? Whether it's Ice Cube or Public Enemy or even N.W.A., right, even rank and file rappers, right, who were mainstream artists, found a moment to do something political, right? Big Daddy Kane, right, is another good example. That even, you know, someone like LL, who's never been particularly problematic and whose politics actually are problematic in some ways in terms of its social conservatism now, you know, he could do a song like Boomin' System, right, which talks about being pulled over by the police and things of that nature, right? So, you know, it's a sad state, at least for me in that regard.
You know it's funky, 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 cause you heard it from his seat. A jam that you love that don't be getting no airplay. Strictly for frontin' when you're riding around. 12 o'clock at night with your windows down. Headlights breaking cause your battery's drained. Armor roll on your tires and a big gold chain. Parking outside all the hip-hop spots. Push the EQ and play connect the dots. Leaning to the side, people everywhere. The trunk full of amps, ain't no room for a spare. Big beats bumping with the bass and back.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's just been amazing to talk with you, actually. It's just like, we want you back and back. It's just, you know, there's a great intersection with what you...
Thank you.
Everything you write and say and with, you know, and with such, you know, so articulate and with such style as well. It's just been one non-stop pleasure. One non-stop funk disco 12-inch. but so thanks very much indeed.
You're welcome.
Hi folks, producer Matt here. If you want to hear an extended version of this conversation, including a discussion of sampling culture, Beyonce, Saturday Night Fever and more, head to patreon.com and become a patron from as little as £3 a month.